Welcome back to the Speech Uncensored podcast. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm a medical speech and language pathologist located in San Jose, California. And we are wrapping up this year's season of How I Practice. And I'm joined by two special guests today who have created an app for people with aphasia, and it's called Med Concerns App. And our topic today is promoting healthcare equality for people with aphasia using a tool like this app. So I'd like to welcome speech and language pathologist Hillary Sample and her colleague, Dr. Stephen Richman. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. We're excited to be here.
Thank you also. Very glad.
All right. So before we dive into today's topic, I'd love for each of you to tell me a little bit about who you are, what you do, and where you practice.
Okay, I'll go first. I'm Hillary Sample, speech pathologist. We're both located in Cleveland, Ohio. I have spent most of my career in inpatient rehab hospital. I also work in acute and outpatient and dabble a little here and there, but my primary areas that I love to work with are aphasia and dysphagia. So the stroke population is definitely near and dear to my heart. I have had a short but very full career. I started practice in 2019 and kind of got out the door running, especially toward patient advocacy. It's been something that is just, as soon as I stepped into the field, it's one of those things that I saw it can be our primary goal, or that the primary thing that I want to focus on with people is supporting their rights. And that's with people with dysphagia. And we could go on with that forever. But today we're talking about people with aphasia. And certainly what I saw time and time again is an area where we can be, where we, and later myself and Dr. Richman, we could come together to help these people have more access to healthcare or equal access to healthcare. So my whole journey has kind of culminated in this, which has been really rewarding.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stephen Richman. I started as a family physician with a regular family practice office, and I gradually moved into inpatient rehab, first part-time, then full-time. Did some skilled nursing work too. In the inpatient rehab world, I got exposed to lots of people with brain injuries and strokes that had aphasia, and I kept running into the question of how do I communicate with these people? Although I was trained in lots of interesting things, communicating with people with aphasia was not one of them. Interestingly, Hillary mentioned, you know, patients' rights. I've always been a proponent of patients should be involved in their decisions, as I think we all believe and want to happen. And how do you do that when you can't communicate? Hillary and I met and started talking and learned a lot from each other, and that's where we got to where we are today.
So I was doing my own little nerdy thing with, I had seen and I think probably a lot of your listeners might be able to relate to this, where you're sitting and you're watching a provider engage with a person with aphasia and with no communication supports, and it's just kind of falls flat, and the provider cares, but they leave really empty-handed, and the person with aphasia is left in the room not having really received much in the way of communication with their provider.
Yeah, talking about leaving empty-handed, for a long time, I'd walk into rooms of people with severe aphasia, trying to communicate, mm-hmm. trying to get something useful out of our interaction, and leave wondering what did we accomplish, and just feeling not like I want to feel when I walk out of a patient's room. Not, you know, I want to walk out feeling like I have a plan that makes sense for this patient, and instead I walk out questioning.
So I had... we use supportive communication approach or communication supports. And so I'm always in the room with a big pad of white paper and my big black marker and, you know, writing keywords and big print and giving choices and all the things. And so I would come out of the room with knowing what the patient's medical concerns were and not being a doctor, but like doing my best to find out. And a lot of times it's very thorough because, as your listeners probably know, we can have complex discussions with people with aphasia using simple syntax, using simple language, but we don't have to meet them at a lower level of complexity emotionally or, you know, cognitively, just because they have more difficulty communicating. So I would come and I'd bring all this stuff, and over time, what I realized is, and I had made some assumptions, and we can talk about that later, but I came to realize that despite program development and some training for use of communication supports. I hadn't seen much in the way of change except for improved engagement with people with aphasia. And so I kind of started wanting to create something that could be used by anybody. And that was kind of a paper pencil thing, but I'm no physician. So I knew this doctor who has the heart of gold and I just knew that he'd be willing to have a conversation, and he was.
So backing up, Hillary would sometimes come with a long list of what's going on with the patients. When I just left the room, we got nothing. And that was eye-opening. And eye-opening in a really basic sense that, you know, it's so easy to forget or not realize how much is going on in someone's mind when they can't speak it. And and I was apparently falling into that trap far too often. So it was both eye-opening that there are ways to get at that and reminding me that, yeah, there's a lot more going on than I might always pick up on.
Yeah. And so we started kind of, when we had that initial conversation, we started figuring out how we could put our skills together to create a resource. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit today, but, the MedConcerns app was the result of that, that coming together.
Nice. That's really awesome. I loved hearing that story about the very different experiences both of you were having, where Hillary, you could get so much information from the patient, but Steve, you would like go in there and it would just be like, okay, nothing. And so you're both could be like ships passing in the night. Mm-hmm. And so like, but you came together and you're like, here's the information. And then you're both like, well, how can we make this consistent? How can we get this every time with every patient? What can we do? So tell me what you did.
Okay. Oh, I love it. It gives me chills when I think about it, because, you know, so often we have our concern, our fear of coming to a doctor and communicating, but like with a person who's open and willing to have those conversations, we were able to do something really cool for our patients, which is to embed communication supports into an app that assesses medical concerns.
Which we definitely want to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the other thing, which is just so basic that I'd been missing, and many of us physicians, I think, miss, are taking advantage of the fact that we have speech therapists right in the building with us. Why not drag them in the room? Why not?
Yeah.
Why not get them more involved? Collaborate more. In part, I was going with, hey, they have their therapy time. I try to go in between therapies because they're here for the therapy, not thinking, well, I should just grab the therapist to make my visit better. And I think that's eye-opening on both ends. Both SLPs could approach docs could approach SLPs. We both could benefit from that, and I never thought about it.
Yeah.
But then we did move on to building our app where I don't have to. I mean, it's great if I can have an SLP in the room with me, but if I don't, at least I've got something that works much better than me without.
And we'll get into this more because it's so important. One of the assumptions that I said that I was going to talk about more, and I am not proud of it, but it is what happened in my mind, is I kind of just thought this wasn't about Dr. Richmond. I know he cares. But I kind of assumed maybe it wasn't important enough to go the extra mile for the patients.
Why us doctors were not using supportive techniques? Because we didn't know, but Hillary didn't know that we didn't know.
Yeah. So the more, you know, in my conversations with Dr. Richmond, like really got to know the human side of what they're doing as well. And just, you know, and then we dove into reading the literature, and it talks a lot about how like people, like healthcare providers want to help. They have no idea how to help. They weren't given the training to know how to help, and they're still not given the training to help. There's a movement toward it, but it's slow, and it's definitely not widespread.
Now, a few places are doing some good things, which is great. But yeah, I know I never saw it when I was in med school, and it sounds like a few med schools have it. Wonderful. Yeah. But we still need it to be far more widespread.
You talked about being trained to communicate, but
oh yeah, we were definitely trained about the importance of communication, establishing rapport, being able to help establish trust. And it went so far as to say that if you can really communicate well with your patient, the exam, the labs, those are all kind of secondary, just to confirm your diagnosis or fine-tune your plan. And there's a lot to that. That may be overstating, but yeah, communication is that important. Where when I went to med school wanting to know how to use my stethoscope, I left med school realizing I need to really listen and really talk and communicate. So that's where the real medicine figuring out things comes from.
And then, so that's like normal rapport building, but what the literature told us is that physicians are generally not taught how to communicate with people with disabilities, much less people with communication disabilities. So the unique communication needs that we face, which if we can get the hang of it, can be kind of simple if we work on it. Those same things are just not known. They didn't know it. And so it helped. Like when I was doing training and doing the program development that I was talking about, and I'm guiding people on supportive communication, I'm like, why isn't this going? It makes sense because there's a good amount of education that goes underneath us being able to learn and implement supportive communication. And then, you know, when we do communication partner training and things like that, there's a large amount of care and compassion and love and desire to communicate with their loved one that will also support their, you know, the communication partner's use of those things. Right. And so what I kind of realized and what we realized is we really needed to make it so that it was easy, no matter the level of training. So the app is, it presents in an aphasia friendly manner, which we can describe more, but in an aphasia friendly manner, it presents options for various medical concerns that a person might have, from pain to something's going on with my PEG tube, to trach, to stitches, to.
But before it jumps into that, it starts with opening the conversation. Mm-hmm. It has a screen to introduce yourself. Has a screen to ask the patient, how are they? So you're doing what you can to at least establish some rapport. Yes, I have a general interest in how you are. And then, of course, into, yeah, what are the particular concerns today we want to talk about?
Yeah. When you get to the concerns page, you have a variety of options. And then each selection that's made can take the person to a confirmation page, just like we would with communication supports. We would verify our understanding, and that they meant to say what they said.
Can I interrupt for a second? Uh-huh. Confirmation pages. I used to hate them, and now I feel the opposite. I did not get the concept that when you have a communication disorder, you might make mistakes in pointing to the right pictures or indicating the wrong thing, and you need a confirmation page to possibly correct that. I just didn't get that for a long time. And now, not only do I get that, it's like, we need a confirmation page. We need a confirmation page. It's really been neat to see that change within myself happen. Yeah. And I find some patients that are higher, that have less problems with their aphasia that are using the app, yeah, they kind of get bored with those confirmation pages, but just click yes. Whereas some people, they need those pages. And without them, I would never maybe know what they really want because I'd be going down the whole wrong rabbit hole.
And you need language skills to be able to repair language errors. And it's not that easy for people with aphasia to, once they've made the wrong selection, to say, oh, wait, go back. I actually meant to say something else. Well, if you could say all that, you probably wouldn't be using the app. So we wanted to make sure that those tools that we consistently are trained to use with people with aphasia are automatically used in the app. So a provider would hand the person the app. They'd have the pictured concerns with the written text and the audio saying the same word.
Layered, as you taught me.
Layered modalities. And then the person makes the selection. They get a confirmation page. If they say no, they go back to the previous screen. If they say yes, they go to the next. And just like we would do where, you know, if I'm asking about something, I have the subtopics or the sub, you know, concerns. So if it's something about, something simple, like if I want to find out what their favorite drink is, well, I put all my list of drinks and then they say juice. Well, then I'm going to go to sub choices. So apple, orange, cranberry, you know, and this is more important sometimes because we're talking about medical concerns, but same idea for how to get that specific information clearly conveyed. So they're able to go through until they have clearly communicated as well as we've been able to do with the app to get to that concern and to describe the symptoms associated with that and the level of severity and all of that and the onset. And then you get a summary page at the end that tells the physician or whatever provider or care partner that's using this app with the patient, or the person with aphasia, it tells them exactly what all the things that they've pushed and described throughout, so you can have a nice summary.
Oh, nice. Okay. So let me see if I can summarize what I understand so far about the MedConcerns app. So this is geared towards providers, and they're going to have this on a digital tool like a tablet that they can provide to the patient that they're working with and communicating with who has a language, some sort of language barrier, and not as in they know multiple languages as in aphasia. So is it also, though, that patients can have this to communicate with their providers? Like, it's for both directions?
It is definitely for both directions. We're trying to make this universal, which has made it more challenging than we expected. But we want it to be so providers can have it with them as a tablet or iPhone or Android phone, okay. Mm-hmm. Or whatever they have. Or patients could have it, or patients' families could have it.
Your friends.
So in our ideal world, people in the hospital would have it. Or when you're home, you could bring it with you to the doctor's office. Or your spouse might have it, or so that way when there is a medical concern that needs discussed, whether it's in the hospital or at the doctor's office or with your loved ones, you've got this app available to help do that.
The thing is, we started thinking about healthcare providers because people with aphasia and facing other communication barriers, we are at 3 times higher risk of preventable adverse medical events. And that's some of what we experience there. But a person with aphasia or a communication barrier of some sort has the need to communicate with not just their providers, but with their family and so on and so forth. So the tool is meant to be intuitive for the person with aphasia to use and for whoever is using it with them so that whoever they need to report their concern to, they can do that. And it's not a diagnosis. So it's like just providing the vocabulary to communicate that concern clearly and with details so that it can be met appropriately.
So one handy example is we both are friendly with this patient named Bob. And he unfortunately had this problem before he had the app. We met Bob early on and we stayed in touch. And he and his wife were very supportive of each other. He ended up having bad hip pain. He had a stroke previously. As many of us know, it's common to have neuropathic pain after a stroke. So the assumption from his physicians, and I suppose from his wife, was he was having hip pain from neuropathic pain, nerve type pain. And it took, I think, 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 visits until someone actually did an x-ray and found he had a broken hip, which was, really, really hard. It wasn't too long afterwards when we finished our first version of the app and we're sharing a copy of it with him and his wife. And he was all over that app showing us how we could go from I have pains, pointing where the pain was, describing the pain. That describing the pain with when you don't have the words and is so difficult. Yeah. But when you have the app and the choices, and it is clearly not going towards that burning, numb, tingly, no neuropathic symptoms, he's doing sharp pain. He's doing stabbing pain. But if he had that up front, think how much quicker he might have gotten diagnosed properly.
It was great to see how easy it was for him to use and the relief. Like when some people might think that upon first looking at the app that it's complicated, it's not, it's intuitive. When a person with aphasia, a lot of times, depending on their level of severity, of course, and I don't mean to minimize that part, but a lot of times they've been longing for you to present something for them to point to, you know what I mean? And when he got something to point to and he's at a level where he could really use this with a field of 6 and he could move through it very easily. So that's the level of aphasia where he is. But it was like, he was like, yeah, like as he moved through it. And it was just like, to be able, when we come from that patient advocacy, standpoint, like when you can give someone the opportunity to just say what they've been wanting to say, it's like, it's just so joyful. Like it just means the world to us. So that's the goal. And then, for people that don't have, that a field of 6 is too visually distracting or their neglect makes that too difficult or a myriad of other things where it's not easily discernible for them or as useful. The app has in settings, you can narrow the field so you can make it from a field of 1 all the way to a field of 6. You can also change the language and change the gender depending on the voice you want to hear and the body that you want to see on the pain. But changing the field so that it's accessible. Again, accessibility is our goal here. That was something that we wanted to make easy to use as well.
Yeah, and that's something I'm still learning. I will sometimes go in and assume that field of six is good. You see all these options, mm-hmm. and I get reminded by a friendly SOP that maybe they just want one or two up at a time, or maybe three is better. Or certainly I also, we have a version on the phone. On my phone, three fits better than six as far as just easier to see. But it's interesting thinking about those things I don't normally, didn't used to think about.
So if someone does need to go all the way to just answering yes, no questions, and they're not yet at that place where they can choose between a binary choice or a greater number of choices, then they can just, you can select it and they're just given that yes, no, same thing, that it would just take them back to the next thing. So they can go one picture at a time, which actually zooms in if that's more accessible to them as well. But they can go all the way to where they're not yet making a choice between options. They're doing yes, no's.
Okay. All right. Good. So I keep clarifying, like as I get more information. So this is not like an AAC app for broad communication needs. This is really targeted to a conversation with a provider discussing right in the moment medical concerns.
It's for discussing medical concerns right in the moment with mm-hmm. your provider, with your loved one, with whoever you need to discuss it with. As we all experience, if you're at home and something comes up, you're trying to tell your family about what's going on. But yes, it's definitely geared towards medical concerns.
And you can, if a person needs to use it beforehand, because, you know, we know how stressful those encounters with physicians are. Sorry, but true. just because that's the moment where you have to communicate effectively right then and there, and you don't get a second chance in it, you know? They can go through the app and get to the summary page before the appointment and just bring in the summary page and just confirm that with their provider, if that's a more useful way to use the app with their provider.
Right. And for people with the app, they can also just practice so they see all the different options and be sure they've explored the options that they want. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. But as we've continued, we've also built in education pages. Right now it's about aphasia and why they have aphasia potentially and what they might be experiencing with aphasia, or if they might have apraxia, what that might be like as well, so that it's aphasia friendly. You know, it's easy to understand.
The education page, I think, has been huge. Hillary was insistent we put it in. I'm so glad she is insistent. She always teaches people about their aphasia as part of what she does. And I always assume if someone has aphasia, by the time they get to me in inpatient rehab, someone's taught them. But boy, am I wrong. And mm-hmm. the times when I've been the one to teach them a bit about aphasia using the app where it's got some simplified pictures and explanations, that it's really been neat to see people get a sense of, at least have an understanding what's going on with me. And that understanding, as we all know, is huge. You know, people hate it when they have mysterious symptoms that don't make sense. And even if the diagnosis isn't necessarily good, just the understanding is always helpful.
Mm-hmm. And you never know when someone first introduced them to the idea of aphasia or how they did. Did they use aphasia-friendly materials to do that? Did they even understand? Did they have, like, were they very acute and they didn't have the ability to yet understand in the way that it was presented? So it's so important. Like, when I've, almost every single person where I've described their aphasia using aphasia-friendly communication and tried to support them in communicating what they're experiencing back to me, it's been like the first time they've ever heard it. And that's in IRH, you know, inpatient rehab level. And that's also happened once or twice in outpatient too. So it's this, you know, we can't take anything for granted when it comes to whether or not somebody might have made the communication exchange accessible to the person with facing a communication difficulty or challenge. But so as we've gone, yes, that's what it is for. That's its primary purpose. And then we're like, well, why don't we throw this in and this in and this in? So we also have a topic board where, again, they can communicate with their providers. Most of the things are geared toward a conversation that just to guide the provider on what to talk to them about.
So some of those common questions that show up in inpatient rehab after a brain injury, after a stroke, like, what about kids? What about money? What about, you know, life in the real world? We have, I think, 20-ish questions
Mm-hmm. What happened to me? Yeah, am I going to be okay?
Yeah, we have a bunch of pre-written questions that you could select among if, hey, I want to discuss this. Mm-hmm. And so even if you can't say the whole question, but that is a common question that people may want to discuss, it just gives an easier way to open that discussion.
Yeah. Instead of like, is there anything you want to talk about? Or assuming we can't like get present to you topics, is there anything else you might want to go over? And then, yeah, I want to talk about intimacy with my partner, you know, and that's an option that they can hit.
And you phrased that so well. I was trying to say that one. I didn't have the right words.
We have it written quite clearly, because why not? Yeah. But so there's also a needs board. So, and that's gotten a lot more, like we have a lot more added to it in the update that's going to be live in like, well, we never know, but you know, it should be.
it should be in a few days. Yes. So they keep telling us. Back to the topic board for a second, because my mind was going blank, so I just pulled it up to check. But yeah, some of the other questions about, you know, what about money? What about follow-up appointments? What about this feeding tube I have? Will I get better? Tell me about discharge, communication. All those topics are, you know, easy to pick, easy to then open up a discussion on when, regardless of whether you have the vocabulary for it, we're providing the vocabulary.
But they're almost impossible to initiate from the person. Or, yeah. With just tech, because they're more abstract, you know? Mm-hmm. Going back to the
needs board.
Yeah, the needs board. So sorry, I keep flying around.
You're good.
We get excited. So we've added quite a lot, like anything you might want. And of course, the list could go on forever, but anything they might want to request.
So we started with just basic things that you would see in any basic needs: bathroom, bed, food, drink, glasses, medicines. We've added 40 more, I think, so far. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll add more in the future. But, you know, things like, you know, call family, plug in my phone.
Repositioning.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with my catheter, you know, things like that. Or I'm soiled, like need change, things like that.
So, again, trying to make it so people that don't have the vocabulary but have the thoughts and needs have an easy way to communicate it. Mm-hmm. So our hope is that, especially with something like the needs board, if you have your aide or your nurse has this app or you have this app, it'd be so much easier to get these across. And unlike a paper needs board that might or might not have what you want, here, again, if you confirm it, here you've also got whiteboard.
Yeah. Here, well, before we go into that, I was just going to share about communication boards. So, you know, well, if we can talk about the regulatory bodies in a little bit, I think it's an important point, but that we're supposed to have effective communication with our patients.
There's some regulatory bodies that talk about what we should be doing in medicine, as we're all well aware. And the ADA Act of 1990, it says health organizations have to provide effective communication to all patients with disabilities, including those with communication disabilities.
And then that was followed up with Section 1557 of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that requires healthcare organizations to provide effective communication, which includes the provision of auxiliary aids and services such as hearing assistive devices. But you could see how that would also be supportive communication or communication supports.
And the Joint Commission, who accredits hospitals, they require the hospital effectively communicates with patients when providing care, treatment, and services. And they go on to say, it goes on to imply, if we haven't determined if what we give is effective, we haven't met the standard.
And so often we would see is that if something's given, it's a communication board that is put in front of the patient. It might be line drawings, it might be a little bit, you know, more appropriate or whatever. But the thing is that it might be, we talked about a field mattering, right? The visual field mattering, like it might be like 30 things and that person just really doesn't have the ability to use that yet. It's not effective for them. It doesn't mean they can't communicate using something with a field of 4, you know, but that field of 20, it just isn't conducive to them advocating for their needs. So I had started with doing, you know, some of that programming I was talking about is like different levels of communication boards. You have a field of 4, you have a field of 6, you field of 9. And I would, and you kind of, the SLP would help the the healthcare staff and giving this person a communication board that was accessible. So one of the things that we've looked at is that, you know, the ones that are given, they're not necessarily effective. So we wanted to make the one that's embedded in ours able to be changed. So we know the field can change, but also with the update that's coming in a few days to a few weeks, by the time this airs, it will most surely be. You have the ability to deselect items or hide items. So if you really do need four main options, and you just really can't have all that clutter because those needs aren't being met, and we need to make sure those needs are being met, you can hide all the other options and be left with that field of four most necessary items, and then increase it from there whenever you want. But the goal is to have a dynamic communication board.
Yeah. And since we work in the inpatient rehab world, we have needs like trach and PEG related, but if those don't apply to you, deselect them. You don't need to have that stuff if it doesn't apply to you.
I like that it can be adjusted for the different severity levels or different levels of medical complexity that the person might be experiencing, because hopefully that will decline with that person as well as they go through their recovery stages. So as they need those things, they're there. And when they progress and improve and those things aren't present anymore, then they don't need to talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the same thing can happen for the concerns too. If you're a healthcare provider that doesn't see certain populations, you can leave it off, you know, trach, PEG type of thing. But for a person, like you said, who is this for? If a person has it for their own use, they don't need all these other things. They don't have a wound to address. They don't have a trach or PEG or something to that extent. Then they can hide the concerns too. So you can also have a dynamic concerns page.
You mentioned about ask people improve, and that all, not always, but this brought up a story which I guess always brings up the story for me. Nowadays, when I go in patient's room and they have aphasia, I feel I'm not doing my job if I don't at least present the app, because I never know who's going to pick up something from it. And some people have too many deficits, and some people are doing just fine and choose not to. But the most interesting ones, in my mind, are people that use that for a few days and then kind of start to get a little bit bothered I'm showing them the app. And I'll say, I just want to double check. And one of these gentlemen recently, well, a few months ago, I guess, I showed him the app after he said everything was fine. And he clicks on fatigue and he goes through it. He's tired because of a medication he's taking, or he's worried he's tired because of a medication, which indeed was a new medication. And he just knew he didn't have the vocabulary to say that. But with the app, we could get to that. It was just fascinating to see, yeah, his language has improved a lot, but this can still be really helpful.
There's still language to communicate medical concerns is still really abstract. So people that are getting a lot of their communication back, you know, we see a lot of patients with aphasia have chronic aphasia, but we can see improvement. We can see some more words coming back, but still when it comes to something stressful, like a very stressful encounter, which trying to get your words out in a short amount of time, for, you know, with a provider or with whomever is going to be listening to you, or trying to get something out that's been really bothering you, that has kind of that high emotional weight, all those things can change language abilities in the moment, you know, can really decrease what they're able to say. As stress does the same for me, like I will stutter on my words, I will have word finding problems when I'm super stressed. So we just, you know, there's never a time where I feel it's appropriate to not offer communication supports when someone has language deficits, because I don't want to make assumptions that limit their ability to communicate effectively with me. So that's what, that situation, the guy who was kind of like, well, I don't need it. But when he did go ahead, well, let's go ahead and just make sure, he actually had something to say that he wasn't able to verbalize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The point a few minutes ago, when we've done a decent amount of reading about about research that's been done in literature that relates to aphasia and physician visits and interactions, and it's pointed out over and over, which, you know, we all know physician visits can be stressful and can feel rushed at times. And I know from the physician side, you know, it's sometimes challenging to see all the people you want to see in the time you have. And one of the interesting dilemmas that we read about, which I think is very real, is if you're in a room with the patient and the patient can't say what they can't effectively communicate. Instead of working harder or longer, if the physician doesn't know how to work harder or longer, they may just cut the visit shorter because mm-hmm. what's anybody gaining from this? Mm-hmm. And it's just...
There was a lot of literature that talks about that. So some of it, and this might just be like reading a list, but I'm going to read a little list, is healthcare providers do not know how to communicate with people with aphasia. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 articles, and we could list more that just for that one statement. And we've listed some of those, and the show notes will have those. Healthcare providers report feeling ill-prepared to care for people with communication disabilities. Healthcare providers receive a lack of training on communicating with patients with any type of disability and have limited training related to unique communication needs. Healthcare providers don't typically ask SLPs for help. And then, so it talks about those who, so it talks about the perspective of nurses, for instance. Nurses who perceive that communication takes too long may avoid communication. Healthcare providers tend to use close-in questions and limit turn-taking, reducing the person with aphasia's yeah. ability to exert control over the interaction. These things are ongoing.
And all true and real. And this also, as we all have probably experienced, this often leads to healthcare providers turning to the care partner, which is certainly better than not getting information, but the care partner, well-intentioned, may or may not really know what the person wants.
And there's literature about that too, you know, is that they might be right and they might be wrong. Yeah. So 50-50 chance. But like we talked about talking with a lot of times when somebody's has effective verbal communication, when the care partner jumps in and talks over the person, we're kind of like, okay, let me get back to the person that I'm working with.
Yeah. It's so interesting because I know myself when I have a person and their loved one in the room and the person communicates well and the loved one starts to talk over them, I really want that loved one to talk less because I want to hear from the patient directly. But when I can't get the information from the person
in the way normally,
and certainly before I had any means of doing so, I want that loved one's input because, and not that I don't want it in the first place, but it's interesting how...
It's a substitute.
Yeah.
It's a quick, like we go to that. And I'm guilty too, especially before I... You know, earlier on, before I recognized my own limitations in this area and what I wasn't doing, I just want to be able to get my questions answered, you know? And like, I didn't realize how, you know, one, I could be getting incorrect information, but two, how that must feel for a person with aphasia to just be so dismissed so quickly. I was talking to a patient today and, this person doesn't have aphasia, but this person has, dysarthria from cerebellar ataxia. It's really quite significant. Although they do a really great job of using every strategy in the book and making their communication known. If they don't have a patient listener, oftentimes they won't be heard regardless of the amount of effort they put into it. And, they were describing for me how they've been treated, and this person's cognitively intact, like doing better than I'm doing on an average day, you know, and, how this person's been called names, how this person's been treated like they're incompetent, how this person does not actually no longer has the right to decide different things because they have a POA and that was never given back to them. So I'm not going to go into it too deeply, but when there are communication impairments, and or any kind of barriers like that, we're so quick to judge it as, indicating their level of intellectual ability. And we're just quite frequently wrong.
So, So Hillary uses this example, which I love, about would she still be as intelligent as she is if she's suddenly in Japan and can't speak Japanese and needs to do something.
Right. And that's borrowed, if I'm just suddenly dropped in a foreign country, and I know a lot of us SLPs will use that with informing the families, you know, if I'm dropped in a foreign country and I don't speak the language, I'm still me. I'm still competent. I still have the skills. I still have my likes and dislikes. This one thing still, you know, grinds my gears and all the things, right? I'm still me. I just can't speak Japanese, for instance. So altered language ability or lack of the same language skills that they had prior, it is not one and the same as being cognitively impacted. But it's so quickly the way that we determine it.
Yeah,
and we make quick judgments. That's human nature. But our goal is to like let people know, like, we make quick judgments. You're not alone. We do it too. We all do it. Let's own this and realize that the impact of this is one, frustration and isolation and just lack of rights for our individuals with aphasia that we're working with. And then on the provider side is frustration and nervousness and not feeling confident about their making diagnoses, that their diagnoses and their treatments are effective. And then, of course, that same literature that talked about that people with communication barriers are 3 times more likely to experience preventable adverse medical events, which could include death. 3 times more likely. And that study was actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, that study was fascinating. Bartlett did that up in Canada. And he said, you looked at people with the communication barriers, and often the barrier was simply they did not speak English or French, which are the two languages there, of course. And everything else might be intact, but still 3 times more likely to get adverse medical events simply because of communication problems.
So 3 times more likely. And then, you know, they talked about their sample size in that article was 3% of the people actually had communication deficits. Well, we know generally in the U.S. population, or any communication deficits, not barriers, but deficits. So something we would treat, right? Dysarthria, aphasia, voice. Okay. So we know that 10 to 15% of the U.S. non-institutionalized population have communication deficits disorders. And so that sample size was not really reflective of that either. So 3% in that sample size versus 10 to 15%, that's more accurately representative of the population. So what they said in that article is it's probably a very conservative estimate is 3 times more likely to experience adverse medical events, which is crazy, but it's also makes perfect sense. If I'm one of the first situations that, or one of the ones that was most profound that like hurt my heart early on in my career was I had a individual with aphasia I was working with using communication supports. They're in there, right? We know they're in there. And that person responded very well to communication supports with pointing. Needed a little bit of support in general to act, you know, to start the pointing. But once that person got it, it was on. They were crying profusely and had quite a few healthcare professionals in the room that were trying to console them and make them feel better. And I was walking down the hallway and one of the therapists grabbed me and said, like, Hillary, can you help? We're trying to help her, help to understand what's going on with her. We're trying to make her feel better, but we can't figure it out. And, I walk in the room again, crying profusely, and I started with communication supports and found out quite quickly, because I always start with like worst case scenario. Well, this person was having a heart attack. And so what does it look like? It makes me always want to just cry when I think about it. What does it look like when I am in emotional anguish? I might hold my heart and I'm crying and I'm, you know, like my, I'm distraught. What does it look like when I'm having a heart attack? You know? And so the thing is, unless we know how to communicate or how to support communication with people that don't have it readily available, we can so easily misjudge even when we care so much. And so that moment in time where right away, it took me like 20 seconds to help her get that information out. I just quickly wrote a few things on white paper and there we go. And she pointed, she knew what she wanted to say so badly. Right. And she was off to acute care. And like that made me just take a step back and see all the literature that tells us like people want to help. They don't know how to help. What can we do to help? And then thinking about, you know, we wanted to make a resource to make it easier because training takes time. Policy changes take time, you know, widespread change within how we practice. And especially with the time restraints that we're given, like it takes time and these people cannot afford the time it takes for those things to be implemented. So that's was one of the big things that made us want to just get it out there and get it used. And so if you give it a try and if it helps, awesome, because one person didn't have to wait 17 years for research to practice or for new policies to be implemented. You know, they What happens to that person? What would have happened to that person, that woman that I worked with, had somebody not used communication supports with her? I mean, they might have gotten to that, but would it have been too late? It takes time when you're kind of trying to figure it out without communication.
We sometimes would like to go through with our app. Hillary could do in a few minutes what used to take a session, and I can do in 5 or 10 minutes, which I could never do before.
That's awesome.
Fun. Yeah. But it's true, because like when you go into a room and, you know, one of the situations was a person had fatigue. You know, they had talked to their provider or communicated with their provider, and their provider had left without information. And I used communication supports. It took me about 30 minutes to go from the list of things that I came up with, right? And we got to fatigue, and we got to medication as a cause. And then the concern was how it was impacting therapy. And she was scared she was going to have to leave rehab, or she's going to get kicked out because she's not making good gains. That's pretty much what it came down to. And there was actually the onset was consistent with a new medication time or being started, and her doctor was able to make that change. But I didn't have the app. I was creating something on the fly, which takes time, especially because I'm not a doctor and I'm trying to use the non-doctor brain that I have to come up with all the choices and where they would lead a physician, you know, necessarily. And so that would take me time. But now that exact thing is embedded in the app.
So what I love is we use the embedded supportive communication techniques, which Hillary's taught me about, and we use the medical, this question leading to this question, and what should the next set of questions be, and put that together in a way that, works a lot better than not having it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is quite literally collaboration into, you know, built into a tool, so... Yeah. I'm happy I don't have to pretend I'm a doctor. I wasn't pretending I'm a doctor, I promise. But I don't have to, you know, search for something that I don't actually know and try to find somebody in the hallway that might be, but, you know, he used the information that he knew that he was trained on to guide, you know, the questions and how they would proceed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, that we would need both perspectives, you know, the SLP perspective on how to communicate, how to offer, how to scaffold those levels of communication. Mm-hmm. But then we can take it in any direction. How do we know what would be the next logical decision? Like, we need the MD perspective about how you've been trained to make decisions based on the information you get to go in the next direction, you know? So like, this app couldn't have been made by just SLPs or just MDs, right? It takes both.
It takes both.
Yeah. I feel so grateful for that. Such a testament to what can happen when we do collaborate, you know, which if we're talking about like real institutional change, collaboration is necessary. So app aside, it's necessary. And Dr. Richmond showed me what's possible when you do have a physician who's willing to listen, and the humility to say like, oh, I didn't learn that. Let me implement that.
And I was able to learn all kinds of things from Hillary because you don't know what you don't know. And I love this phrase that Hillary uses a lot, showing you know better, do better.
It's essential that we have to immediately try to implement the things. Because if you ignore them, like then you're just a part of the problem, but not knowing them, that's not your fault, you know, so that collaboration is everything, but it also demonstrates what's possible. And hopefully other SLPs might grab hold of their nicest physician friends and see what they can do to support some change, you know, for an increased accessibility for communication, increased access to communication in their hospitals or clinics.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so important because as I reflect back on my career and working in different medical settings, you know, there's a lot of unfair assumptions that I realize now that like I've placed on our medical doctors and other providers like that. I just make unfair assumptions that you've had so much training. Of course, your training includes this thing that I specialize in, but then why would I be there if you had that training, right? And I forget that. I forget that I have a really specialized area of knowledge, and it's not fair if I keep it to myself or only keep it between me and the patients that I'm working with. Like, that needs to be shared. That needs to be explored. and I can't make assumptions that doctors already know it or that they don't know it. Because based on different experiences, different professionals have, like, they've picked things up here or there, but we just can't make those assumptions that, they know it or they don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a great collaborating and learning, and it's opened up some other collaborations at work, which is it's good.
It's always good though to realize you're wrong. And because that's when change can happen. Like, if I had stopped thinking that, they just don't care, or like they're just not making time for it, then that would have ruined an opportunity to be useful. And I always want to be useful. So, but I also, it kind of comes back to SLP responsibilities, I put this on myself as well. When I realized I needed to do better, then I had to put the work in to do better. There's a lot of us that really don't know how to use communication supports. Would you say you've seen that too, Leanne?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of different levels where, like, maybe we hear about it, we talk about it. And then in my own practice, I question if I actually know all the things I need to know. And am I using them accurately, correctly, to the best of their intended purpose?
No, I don't think any of us know all the things we need to know. but I think it's also physician response. I guess it's one of these things, if we're all in healthcare, we're all trying to help take care of patients. And yes, we should use what resources we have. And in the case of physicians, I should be reaching out to SLPs more often. Mm-hmm. And yes, for when it's important for us to learn something, of course, approach physicians.
But that feeling that you're describing, I have it all the time too, is like, there's going to be a hole in there, where I can fill it. And I'm never going to be perfect, and that's okay too. But every time that I've added a little bit of training, a little bit of education, a little bit of reading, I'm better for the next person. I'm more of a useful provider for the next, or clinician for the next person. And that's everything. But I think, one of the things, you guys kind of thought SLPs know this stuff, we kind of leave it to the SLPs, but not all SLPs know it. And I think it's just so important for us to support our SLP colleagues in increased use of supportive communication techniques. One of the things I was telling Dr. Richmond about is how the way that I kind of was introduced to it, and maybe this was just my misunderstanding being a student and things like that, was that supportive communication approach and life participation approach to aphasia, these are two types of therapies that you can do in addition to, ORLA and response elaboration treatment and all these other things. It was kind of like, here's a medication and all these other medication you can take for a headache, but it is the thing. You have to focus on function, and you have to provide a means to communicate. So a means to communicate is the communication supports, and a focus on the person having quality of life and functional gains that matter to them is life participation approach. Those things are not ever off of the list. They are the things that are motivated, like the things that are a necessary part of every single thing I do. And then I might also use these impairment-based exercises and things like that as well. But if if you're a PT, you wouldn't necessarily just not think about if the person needs a wheelchair. You give the person a wheelchair, and you'd also do therapy. So the communication supports to make the environment accessible, it's the same thing, and we can't leave them out.
Yeah, setting the environment is huge. It's kind of like I need for any patient to set the environment to be open so they're comfortable talking with me. Mm-hmm. And in this case, for it to be comfortable talking, we need communication supports in this case.
Huge. And, and one big thing about it is we have to always consider the psychosocial impact of how we're meeting the people that we work with. If I don't kind of engage with you in a way that reveals your competence, and you're stuck in this, hell of not being able to communicate, but knowing what you want to say, if you could say it, there's a lesson in that every single time for people with aphasia or other communication deficits, which is maybe this person doesn't care, or maybe I don't trust this provider, or maybe I shouldn't even try. In our big pile of stuff here, we have literature that shows that when people do have those unsatisfactory, well, here it is, it's right in front of me, where patients find provider interactions stressful or unsatisfactory, they lower their expectations, attend less, and feel generally disaffected. This results in ineffective healthcare. And, but it makes perfect sense, you know, if we had to consider the emotional impact of not coming to the person in a way that they can come back to us, you know, and reveals who they are and their competence, that sits in a way that tells them what to do next or what the world has to offer them. And, you know, it's such an isolating, there's so many ways that we can be of service to these people if we just kind of meet them with tools.
Yeah. That quote reminded me of another one that I can't quite find, but where the person basically said they could be the best doctor in the world, but they can't communicate with me. It just doesn't matter.
It's kind of useless as it was. Yeah. Yeah. And it is, because there's no communication is how, it's another stinking quote that I won't be able to get my hands on, but that's the way that that medical interactions occur. It's through communication. And if, you know, it's the way that we actually interact with our patients. And if we're not doing it, then we're not actually having the effect that we intend. You can take that out. That was mess.
Nope, I'm leaving it in.
She's so powerful. But yeah, so if we are... if we aren't bringing those tools, then we aren't able to be the providers we could be too. So that's important. Yeah.
So we should probably see, we've talked a lot about the app here and there and throughout. I think two things we just hinted at that are worth mentioning. It does come in English and Spanish, so Spanish speaking patients can be helpful. And we found, three things. We found it's helpful beyond aphasia. You know, mm-hmm. people that are hard of hearing and their hearing aids aren't handy. Mm-hmm. People that are mute for whatever reason. It certainly works in populations broader than aphasia, so it doesn't have to be just for aphasia. And it's been helpful in surprising ways there. And then the other thing which I like, it has a whiteboard, so you could type or write or swiggle whatever you want in there, which could be handy if you need to save an idea for the doctor's office or write something down to talk mm-hmm. about or whatever it might be.
Or the doctor might want to use that to explain their understanding of something else, like from the topic board or something, you know, if they don't have paper handy. But yeah, we have found it. So for anyone nonverbal, anybody that could benefit from having a vocabulary to point to, anyone, like if they're, you know, upper airway disorders, somebody that doesn't have a passing ear yet, you know, or they're vented, things like that, we can use it with those patients. You even told me about using it with people that are, that speak a different language as their primary language. And, maybe you didn't quite get that interpreter set up yet, and they're having a medical concern, you could put it before them if you need to meet that need before you can get the call onto the interpreter and set it all up. Right. Mm-hmm. So, because images, if they're understood, are pretty universal, you know, so it can be a useful, quick way to serve our patients.
It's a handy tool in more ways than we were expecting.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's really neat. And it's neat to see how Dr. Richman uses it, how Steve uses it, because I use it as an SLP. And so I do my little SLP stuff. So getting to hear about all of the different encounters that he's had and how he's found it useful, and just that it's something he just kind of moves through. It's just so cool to see it actually working. And there are a lot of people that will give us feedback. One person likes to share with us frequently about how, they reported that they had urinary problems and it was UTI and that was the whole thing. They're changing their cognition and all this stuff, you know. It's just so exciting to see how SLPs and people from and other providers are able to just meet the needs of their patients and how exciting it is for them. What they talked about is that any attempt is better than no attempt, pretty much. And so people with aphasia, they don't care that you're doing it perfectly. They don't care that, you know, it's awesome every try. They care that you try. And that's actually, there's
makes sense.
Literature that supports that. This is they're able to give that information. And I would say, you know, there's just probably not enough literature out there to really indicate the level of need that's there and how much we have to do to support equal access to healthcare, because people with aphasia are often not included in the literature, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's more to learn, and there's so much more that we would like to find out that we could in ways that we could be helpful. But it's a nice jumping off point. We're going to bring it to Asha, and we're hoping to have Android ready.
Yes. Our developer says it will be. We hope that's accurate.
These things take so much more time than you ever think, you know, all the little edits, but hoping to have Android and then and having a promotion that we run during Asha too. So that'd be really exciting.
That's awesome. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you both for your hard work and your insight into creating a useful tool to facilitate that connection between providers and people with aphasia while they're experiencing their medical concerns and addressing those things. It really brings, I think, a lot of dignity and independence back to that person where they can feel an ownership over their ability to communicate those things right in the midst of their recovery process. So thanks for coming on and sharing all the things, all the research. I bet that was super fun.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, always really grateful to talk about this topic in general, but to also share about the tool we made. We hope it can help lots of people. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to share.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to connect and learn more, where can they find out more?
They could go to our website. They could email us. Those both, I think, will be posted. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. They'll be on the show notes.
So our website, you can get there two ways, but medconcernsapp.com or communicationrescue.com. They go to the same place. So whatever you know us by. And our email for general questions is info@communicationrescue.com. You could email me personally, Hillary with one L at communicationrescue.com. It's not Hillary with one L, it's H-I-L-A-R-Y at communicationrescue.com or Steve at communicationrescue.com.
Exactly.
And we would love any, like when people have let us know things that they think would help or experiences they've had, like it all matters to us. So we'd love to hear from anyone.
Great. Awesome. Well, for our listeners who have tuned in and they've made it this far with us, I want to thank them for joining us. And I hope that this conversation has nourished your brain so that your practice can flourish and that you go out there and be awesome. Thanks again, Dr. Richman and Hillary. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.